From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. For more than 40 years, acoustic soul giant Richie Havens has been rocking venues from Greenwich Village to the far corners of the planet. And still, it's his epic 1969 opening of Woodstock that resonates. For almost 3 hours, while other musicians were stuck in the massive crowds of Woodstock, Richie Havens played and played. He played until he ran out of songs, and then he improvised, riffing off the old spiritual Motherless Child. That song became Freedom, the anthem of a generation and Havens' signature. Today, at 64, Richie Havens is still strumming hard, still singing in that unmistakable, soulful voice. The boy who grew up in the tough Bedford-Stuyvesant streets of Brooklyn, son of a Native American father and Black Caribbean mother, inspired a generation. Even the Dalai Lama tuned in. This hour, he's with us, with his music and his message. Tonight on Point, the great Richie Havens.
Castles tend to sink, living on the run, living on the run, but we all see the dark, we all share as one, only battle brings us the sun.
Joining me now from New York is Richie Havens. He has over 25 albums to his name and is still touring strong. His new album is Grace of the Sun. Richie Havens, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Thank you for having us.
It's terrific having you. What a legacy. How many ears tune in and so many memories come up. And yet, I'm reading just from, I don't know, a month or two ago in Washington. The Washington Post has you out at Wolf Trap. You're playing Freedom once again there, and they say Richie Havens, 64 years old, just a couple months ago, and ends this song with a flying scissors kick. Says, you're still packing a rock and roll punch that cannot be overstated. Jaws of all ages stayed dropped, goose flesh stayed goosey long after Havens came back down to earth. Richie Havens, you're 64, it's a long, wonderful life, but what keeps you up there in that flying scissor kick? What keeps you up there and playing and flying, Richie?
Well, I'll tell you, it's two things. One is you never really grow a day older than the day you leave your mom's house. That's why we still act the way we do.
Thanks. I wondered why.
The other one is backwards is not necessarily a negative direction. And I pedal that way as much as I do the other way.
That's great. That's great. We heard behind the opening here, the title track, By the Grace of the Sun, from your new album, Grace of the Sun. I know that you're a message singer, Richie Havens. In 1969, you made it up on the spot at Woodstock, and it was Freedom. What is it today on your new album, in Richie Havens' frame of mind right now? What's your message?
Well, I think, you know, really the songs themselves speak the many messages that come up or come out or through me. It's still the same. It's still the becoming. I call it the great becoming. We are becoming human. We are becoming Americans. We are becoming the world. And that's a very positive thing for me. It's not like it's all gloom and doom like they would like us to believe or scare us into thinking. But it's really that we are coming of age as human beings. And that's something I've been waiting for a long time. You know, since I was about 12, I knew America didn't exist yet, you know.
You have been waiting for a long time. Now it's literally a lot of years. No diminution of that hope? No skepticism about the process?
Not at all. We are well on mark and way beyond where they think we are, the they out there. You know, but we are. And I get to see that every weekend. I'm playing every weekend all year round for the last 28 years and going all over the place. I have seen the fabric woven. That's the best way I could put it. The fabric was there and very, very sparse-like, but I watched the threads go through, and this is now a very, very solid blanket. We are really in the midst of becoming who we were told we were, and which we still aspire to becoming.
Richie Havens, we're going to press you tonight on the texture of that fabric and what's in there, but we want to hear your music as well. We know you've got your guitar there in the studio in New York. We know the great guitarist Walter Parks is with you as well. We should play something from your new album, Grace of the Sun. What have you got for us?
Okay. There's a song called We Both Know. It could have been called Partners, you know.
All right.
But it's something that people go through, trying to love each other. We're going nowhere. You say that somewhere. You say I'm out there. While I am in here, you say there's no time. I say that's my line. When we both know it's true, I say it's a capital crime. Our love should bathe its spine in between times. We're caught in a crosshair because we both care and we both know.
Richie Havens, backed up there by Walter Parks, with We Both Know from Richie Havens' new album, Grace of the Sun. You've got it going there, Richie. You got it going again. It's wonderful. You know, you've watched audiences for so many years now. You've thrown it out there, and you felt it come back. And the kind of review you always get your whole life is that this is a man from your last album, Wishing Well, 2002. This is an artist who can enthrall and enchant. What is it about your voice, your persona? You must have studied this. What is it that goes out there and grabs people and comes back in enchantment?
I really haven't studied it, tell you the truth. You know, I'm so grateful to be doing what I'm doing in a very big way. I feel very blessed to be able to do it and to, you know, still walk out that door and go, they still want me to do this, you know. I learned a long time ago in Greenwich Village when I was on stage down there for 7 years, days a week.
Back in the 50s, 60s.
Yeah, in the late, well, actually the early 60s. Mm-hmm. I learned that the stage did not belong to the entertainer. It belonged to the audience. And if they were not sitting in those seats, you wouldn't be up on the stage. And that stuck in my brain as it's a reverent place for me to be able to go and do what I do. The other thing was I learned something else that seemed to explain to me what was going on was that I called it breathing. You know, I would walk out on the stage and they would applaud, which meant they were exhaling. Yeah, and I was inhaling as I went to the stool. I sit down, I play, I'm exhaling, they're inhaling. And at the end, they applaud, and that's exhaling. And it's their energy that designs what happens on the stage. For true, I know for sure the first and last song I'm going to sing when I go up on the stage.
And that's it. And in the interim, the breathing. It. And pretty soon with that, you've got us all saying Om here.
Yeah.
Richie Havens is with us tonight. His new album is Grace of the Sun. We'll go out here with Dusk, a track from that album by Richie Havens and Walter Parks. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with the acoustic soul giant Richie Havens. Here's his cover of Joni Mitchell's Woodstock from Richie Havens' new album, Grace of the Sun.
I came upon a child of God. He was walking along the road. And I asked him, where are you going? And as he told me, I'm going on down to Yasgur's farm. Gonna join a rock and roll band. Gonna camp out on the land. Try to get my so free. You are stardust. We are golden. And we got to get ourselves back to the garden. Beside you, I have come here to lose the smile, and I feel to be a cog in something turning. Well, it might just be time of year, or maybe it's the time of man.
Richie Havens with Joni Mitchell's Woodstock from his new album, Grace of the Sun, and also from an epic moment in his personal history, maybe the history of the culture and the country, the very beginning of the Woodstock Festival in 1969. You put that right out there on this album all these years later, Richie, and of course it's going to bring us to all kinds of questions. I guess the first one I would put to you is, of course, Joni Mitchell famously was not there. but wrote the song that came to kind of define a lot of our memory, and your opening with Freedom as you played on and on while the other musicians were stuck in the mob, and got the crowd going so high. We had the culture critic Camille Paglia on, looking at Joni Mitchell's song, the one you're singing right there. Mm-hmm. She said, you know, Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young sang it as a kind of marching anthem, like, here we come, this is it. She says that Joni Mitchell, when you hear Joni Mitchell sing it and the way she wrote it, that Joni Mitchell was already seeing this 60s generation kind of peeking out. There's a kind of sadness, a kind of, we're already past the splendor moment of this movement. Now here you are singing it for us in 2005. This generation is famously, you know, joining the AARP. what do you make of it? What do you make of the Woodstock moment, of that boomer generation, of that promise and that freedom? What's it come up to?
Well, it actually has saturated the planet as far as I could see. There still isn't anywhere I go where that isn't the first song they yell out to be sung.
Freedom.
Everywhere in the world, including here, of course. It's because we don't have it yet. It's because we realize we don't have it yet. Because if we did, it would take on, it would have come out differently, I believe. I believe it would have come up from me very differently, and probably celebratory, you know, in that sense of we're going to celebrate this thing. Well, we're becoming that.
You said that earlier, that the fabric is woven, that it's happening. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Give us your evidence. You see a lot of people. You see them in a kind of, very often, in an elevated state when you're performing and they're there. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we all know what it's like to be in the high of the music of a concert. But you also see the world with the rest of us, Richie Havens. You see the war that goes on, disease and hunger and poverty that goes on. And the tensions and frictions and now terrorism on top of all that. So what's the evidence that the fabric is woven?
Yeah, I feel I can call this blanket let me put it this way. It's on its way. It's very interesting for me to try to explain it, because it is happening every moment of our lives at this point. The people that I do get to see out on the road are millions and millions of people who have a like mind about what they lack, what is supposed to be as opposed to what they'd like us to believe it is, and also to scare us into believing other things that it might be. This has been going on since the world began. So for me, we're now in the age of negotiation. That's one of the big things that becoming for me at this point is that, yes, there are people starving. And you know what? We're coming to realize that it's definitely our responsibility to do something about it. I mean, that's what's going on in our government today, is that they are at odds with each other as to whether they'd like to take all the money and run road or do their job as their job requires, you know.
And there's the negotiation, as you call it.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. And as bad as it might seem, it is definitely... I can say the people who are sacrificing at this point are actually sacrificing for the right thing at this particular point, because their sacrifice becomes our spirit, our motivation, you know, to actually now become ourselves and do the work that needs to be done. There are so many people, you know, years ago they called it grassroots. And that would have been like the grandma down the block trying to keep the kids right on the street. Mm. Today, grassroots is the absolute, you know, if there's a carpet, before it goes down on the floor, they put one underneath it. Mm-hmm. That's the way grassroots is today. It's covering every base that our governments have chosen to not acknowledge or address. And we're actually doing it ourselves. You know, it's the difference between President Bush saying we're nation building, and Carter, who's actually building houses for people. You know, that's a big difference.
Richie Havens, you were spotted early on as a positive thinker, and we hear it in just about every sentence we get from you.
Well, you know, for me, it's actually a realism, you know, because I do get to see it, and I do get to touch it and feel it. And the most interesting thing for me is that in all the years that movie, Woodstock, which I don't call it Woodstock, actually, but I won't go into that, that movie has played, every generation who comes of age to see it shows up at my concert. And I'm talking about from 14, 12, 11, 12, 13, especially at festivals. They're there. Young people in groups from high school, and they come together to be there, you know, to see if it's really real, if there's really something to this past.
It was certainly real for a moment. Do us a favor. I know you've told the story a thousand times, but capture that beginning when the vast crowd was gathering there in upstate New York, when the roads were just clogged and people couldn't get through. You were flown in by helicopter.
Yes.
Take us there, Richie Havens, to the opening of Woodstock and that two, three hours that you played.
We arrived very early, like 5 in the morning, because we thought there was going to be so much traffic. However, we actually got to the two hotels where they had all of the musicians come to meet with all of their equipment to be carried over to the field, 7 miles away from the field.
Yazgur's Farm.
And here we are sitting in the hotel all morning long, waiting to see what's going on.
And who's with you? Who's waiting?
I have my guitarist, my kunga drummer, and my bass player was on his way because he decided to come alone. So the poor guy, he never made it to the stage because they made me go on first instead of sixth.
Wow.
If I was sixth, he would have made it. You know, but
fate,
you know,
hurt him.
Yes, it did. But. Here we are at this hotel, and I'm wondering, gosh, what's happening? And they got all the radios on, and it's big, it's huge. And now it's 3:30 in the afternoon. Nobody's left. I'm going, uh-oh, you know. So about
they're going to need some music over there. You know.
Yes, 4:30, 5 o'clock, this helicopter comes down in the Holiday Inn driveway, right outside my window. And I hear a knock on the door, and the guy says, "Richie, would you go over first? You got the least instruments and the least guys." That's how I got over there first.
Right.
Now, okay, I want to go now, you know, and I did. I wanted to be there and be part of that audience.
And as you flew in over that crowd, what did it look like?
Oh, boy, it was a Neiman painting, you know, all these splashes of color. And interestingly enough, you know, the young guys on radio now, they say, oh, 500,000 people. The fact of the matter is there was 500,000 people the first day when I got there. The newspapers, of course, said 250,000, you know, because they did that to us always. They always cut us in half.
But it was big from the beginning, you
say. It was big from the beginning. There were people up there for 2 weeks camping before it even happened, and a lot of them were sitting in the field with their tickets waiting for it to start, and they never even had to give their tickets in because there was no fence anyway. It was free.
And when you when you got through all those hours and you came to this improvisation at the end, and freedom is the word, and who wouldn't feel it?
Well, you know, that was actually the last song.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I'll tell you why. Because they actually chased me for an hour and a half to go on first. I ran like heck. I was going, they're not going to kill me on that stage because the concert's like 12 hours late. I'm out of here, you know.
Right.
And I ran, you know. So I hit a few times, and they finally, you know, convinced me to go on. And when I did, the people were so glad that anything was happening, as far as I'm concerned. I walked out, and they were very happy something was going to happen. And it dawned on me, you know, when I flew over them, I said to myself, if this picture makes the newspapers tomorrow, we will have won. Because now we could really count them from whatever they say. What people don't realize is when they see the movie and they see the hill with the people standing up and starting to clap during that song, at the top of that hill was a road. And on the other side of that hill was a field just as big as the one we were looking at, filled with people who never saw the stage.
And you knew it because you'd just flown
over
it. And in a moment
here
was
we
made.
Are. I go up on the stage, I start singing, and everybody was supposed to be like 30 minutes. So I walked off at 30 minutes, and they go, Richie, nobody's here yet. Can you do four more? No problem. You know, I could do four more. I went back. Well, I went back six times. Six
and
times.
And it was 2 hours and
it was 2 hours and 45 minutes later. I walk off for the sixth time, and they say, Richie, one more. So I go back to the stage and I sit down and I'm playing. If you watch the movie, I'm still playing the last song that I walked off with. Yeah. I sit down and I start tuning my guitar and I'm going, I don't know one more song I could sing. So that long intro is me stalling to figure out what I was going to do.
And then
what came to me was I was looking at the freedom that my entire generation had been looking for since the 50s. That means that I do believe that my generation was a very special generation in that the world changed around us and also within us because we were the last speak when you're spoken to generation.
Mm-hmm.
And that meant we needed to exercise our voice. Well, that became what we call today rock and roll. And that was the 50s. It wasn't the 60s. We were speaking out about our situations as teenagers in the 50s. And that in and of itself, as they, you know, they block off blocks of 10, you know, this was the 50s, this is the 60s,
right.
This is the 70s. Well, they don't mention that it was the same kids in the 50s that became the kids in the 60s that realized they had a voice.
And one of them they could, was you.
Well, Richie, that's the way it happened.
Young Richie
Havens. That's the way it happened.
We want to hear a lot more about your powers as an interpreter, but we want to hear it direct through the music first, if you'd be good enough. Your new album has Bob Dylan's All Along the Watchtower. You're bringing back these big ones here. I'd love to hear that from you live there in New York, Richie Havens,
you
if you'd
it.
Be good enough. Richie Havens
problem.
From his new album, Grace of the Sun, with Bob Dylan's All Along the Watchtower.
There must be some way out of here. Send the joker to the thief. There's so much confusion. I can't get no relief. Business, let me drink my wine. Proud men dig my urn. None of them along the line know what any of it is worth. What any of it is worth. No need to get excited. The thief he kindly spoke. There's so many here amongst us. Think that life is but a joke. You and I, we've been through that. This is not our fate. Let us not speak falsely now. The hour is getting late, 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 late. How?
Richie Havens with Bob Dylan's All Along the Watchtower. We're talking tonight with Richie Havens, the great acoustic soul giant. He joins us from New York City. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
There must be some way out of here. Let me jump back to the field. There's so much confusion. I can't get no relief. Business, let me drink my wine. Rum and dig my hands. Run down along the line. Know what it is worth. Know what it is worth. Know what it is worth.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're joined tonight by the great Richie Havens. He's with us live in New York with his guitar in hand. His new album is Grace of the Sun, but he's been singing a lot for a long time. Here's his cover of George Harrison's Here Comes the Sun, a big hit in 1971. With us again live tonight from Richie Havens.
Little darling, seems like the long, long, lonely winter. Little darling, seems like so many years since it's been there. Here comes the sun. Here comes the sun. And I say, it's all right, it's all right, it's all right, it's all right, it's all right. Little dark seems like the ice is slowly melting. Little dark seems like so many years since it was clear. Here comes the sun. Here comes the sun. And I say, it's all right, it's all right, it's all right, it's all right, it's all right. Smiles are returning to the faces. Little darling, seems like so many years since they've been there. Here comes the sun. Here comes the sun. And I say, it's all right, 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 it's all right. Here comes the sun. Here comes the sun. And I said, it's all right, 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 it's all right. And in the end, the love you say will be the love you gave.
Richie Havens with George Harrison's Here Comes the Sun live with us, and what a gift after all these years, and it still sounds great, Richie. That's just wonderful.
It's the happiest song I know.
And it still works, and I still feel that sunshine. Now, I've got to ask you, you did so many really memorable covers. I mean, when you covered these songs, it became just part of the landscape of an era, and more than one time now. I mean, George Harrison's Here Comes the Sun, Dylan's Along the Watchtower, Just Like a Woman, Van Morrison's Tupelo Honey, we heard Joni Mitchell's Woodstock earlier. What was it, what is it about a Richie Havens cover? How did you choose what to cover, and what is it about the way you do it that makes it stand up, that makes it singular?
That's a really good question. You know, I think it goes back to the beginning with me in the village. I used to sit in the audience and sing along with the guys who were singing the great songs on stage. And I thought, you know, I ought to learn these songs, you know. But it wasn't until Freddie Neil said, hey, you've been singing along with me out there. You know, get a guitar, you know, get up on the stage yourself, you know, sing them. And he encouraged me to do that. And I did. And, you know, the thing about it was that the songs that I started singing were six or seven songs that had changed my life, hearing them for the first time in Greenwich Village. I knew they were much deeper than the doo-wop I was doing in Brooklyn at the time. They encompassed everyone. They didn't just encompass my teenage generation at that time. The interesting thing is that that's what I still do. The songs actually find me. I really don't look for songs. I'm walking through a store. I hear a song on the radio, or I hear it in a record store being played, and I go, I get stopped in my tracks, and I listen. And they are songs that affect me, all of them.
You knew Bob Dylan in that time, I mean, directly and well, as that you describe in your 1999 memoir, They Can't Hide Us Anymore, of course, your line from Woodstock, him coming up to you at a coffee house in Greenwich Village after you'd played A Hard Rain's Gonna Fall. Bob Dylan in tears. think with us for a moment about Bob Dylan then and now. You see the kind of high showman, I don't know, country western troubadour thing that he's doing lately. Does it fit with the young man you knew then?
You know, I think in a way there's an arc there that I could accept. Because, you know, something in the very beginning I knew this guy wanted to be a rock and roller. He wanted to be on stage with an electric guitar playing the leads and doing what he was not able to do with the acoustic guitar. Which is why I think he had so much fun when he got together with Paul Butterfield's band at Newport. He had the foundation he felt that he could emote more with. And I truly do love his original three or four albums because they are purely him. They are his writing and they are his feelings at the time. He wasn't basically just sitting down to write. I think he's a very prolific guy. I think it comes to him, too, and he then sits down and writes it down, very much like I do. I get a title, I see the whole song, I feel and know what the whole song is about, and I just go write the song down. So I think we share things coming through us rather than from us, you know, in that sense.
Richie, you're 64 now. You know, some of the musicians from that era became just hyper wealthy and moved back from performing a bit. Some, like you, were always popular but always performing as well. Either didn't have the urge or didn't have the luxury of sitting back. Now you're 64, and I wonder which looks better, to be out there performing?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. That is really my life. I have been inspired by the songs I sing personally. So it's not very difficult for me to keep singing them. I could sing them for 100 years because I think we're still in the part of the becoming when we need ammunition, we need information, we need inspiration. And that's what these kinds of songs give us. They are our fuel in that sense. And they're my fuel, too. I don't feel any different than anyone else on this planet. And I know that if it does something for me, possibly it could do something for others as well. So that yes, I will be doing the scissor kick for another 10 years.
and that hard strum you do, can you keep that up forever? Boy, it must be murder on the fingers and knuckles.
It isn't really. You know something? The weirdest part about what I do is the guitar is the last thing I think about. I don't even think of myself as a guitar player. I think of myself as creating the music I need to sing the songs that actually changed me. So I really don't think about my guitar playing. It is purely the body metronome for what I do. That foot that's moving on the left side of the stool. I would say if you cut off that foot, the hand doesn't work anymore.
You know? The body metronome.
Kind of a frustrated drummer, you know. And also having sung doo-wop and knowing harmony, I was really able to tune the guitar the way I felt I could use it. And I'm still doing it that way. I mean, this is the only way I know how. it's part of my life. You know, I'm so blessed to get out of town every weekend and go and visit people in three different states. You know, sometimes, you know, it's California for a day, and then next day in Colorado, and next day back east in Florida, and home on Monday.
And there
that's
it is.
The way it's been for 28 years, and it's an incredible thing for me to be able to say.
Richie Havens,
years.
It's a lot of years and a lot of great music, and we're very grateful to you for sharing with us tonight. Walter Parks, with you there as well. Our thanks to you both. It's just been great talking with you.
Thank you very much.
Richie Havens. His new album is Grace of the Sun. Let's go out with a track from that album, When. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Won't you tell me when you leave the phone? Tell me when you leave the phone. Bright side is on top, the bottom is a storm. Transparency is visible, and everybody's home. Won't you tell me when you leave the phone?
On Monday, the nation will celebrate its 229th birthday, while the 4th of July is a time to honor the country. Writer James Carroll finds that celebrating America's beginning also means accepting that someday this great republic too shall end. Here is James Carroll reading his column entitled Intimations of America's Mortality.
We celebrate beginnings, whether of persons or nations, as a way of honoring our place in time. The joyful rituals of July 4th, observed nowhere more happily than in Boston, remind us of the day on which our country came into being. This week we feast on summer food, listen to patriotic music, send up flares, and perhaps choke for a moment on the high emotion of love for this country. But to acknowledge that the United States of America has a beginning and is thus bound by the rules of time is implicitly to recall that this nation will equally have an end. What the 4th of July celebrates at bottom is American mortality. Like every birthday celebration, it defies the human temptation to imagine oneself as living forever. There is a time past when we did not exist, and there is a time future when again we will not exist. To remember the one is to anticipate the other. And everything America accomplishes and signifies must be measured finally against this radical transience within which it all occurs. What could be more obvious, you ask? And yet the truth of our national mortality eludes us. The ultimate demise of the United States is deeply unsettling, even if only in prospect. This is more true of our nation, perhaps, than of others, precisely because we define ourselves in terms more of the future than the past. The greatness of Britain or Greece is tied to what it was, which is why immigrants to those countries, not sharing the past, take on national identity with difficulty. American greatness is always tied to what the nation is becoming, which is why immigrants here feel readily commissioned to create that greatness. The American future belongs equally to everyone. But what if the future is finite, which is another way of asking about death? At Gettysburg, Lincoln suggested that our hallowed dead will not have died in vain. Only if, in the future, the great task remaining before us is accomplished. Lincoln thus gave voice to a basic American assumption that present experience is justified only by future outcomes. But if ever the Union perishes from the earth, will all those who died for it in the past have died in vain? In a world that remains bound by the rules of time and mortality, no matter how cloaked by patriotic fervor, is the characteristically American idea of boundlessness inevitably self-defeating? If America has defined the future as its only absolute, what happens when the future, too, is revealed as relative? This forward-looking ideology has been an engine of industry and social justice, but is it nevertheless built on a contradiction? And why shouldn't Americans have looked for ways to avoid the bite of such questions? Enter God. Here is the context in which to understand the use to which we have put our civic religion. When we claim to be a nation under God, and it was Lincoln who first used that phrase at Gettysburg, or when we blithely pray, God bless America, assuming that God's blessing for this country is unique, we are appropriating for ourselves divine attributes of infinity and immortality that, in fact, have no place on earth. And notice, we do this, 1863, 1954, 2001, when our future seems most at risk, the American variation on faith in foxholes. It should be no surprise that in the current period of acute national anxiety, we have resumed our emphatic dependency on God talk, and no surprise that a court that presumed to question it should have been so efficiently slapped down last week. We Americans feel vulnerable enough without surrendering the sense of transcendent protection that derives from public expression of our felt connection to God. Thus, much more is at stake in our public appeals to God than constitutional questions about church and state. Every nation has a way of invoking the divinity, and every army goes into battle under the patronage of some god or other. Nothing new in that. But the American appeal is different because of the function God serves as a solution to the American problem. We yearn to think of ourselves as the indispensable nation, hoping to postpone the inevitable reckoning with an opposite truth for as long as we can. God is our postponement. On this earth, within the limits of time, no nation is indispensable. No nation is forever. When it comes to the human condition, no nation is exceptional. And if one nation is under God, it is only because every nation is. Therefore, the joy with which we celebrate our nation's beginning must inform equally a sense that our nation's eventual end marks us as part of the human family, which remains America's true glory.
James Carroll's op-ed column appears regularly in the Boston Globe. His latest book is Crusade, Chronicles of an Unjust War. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.